met with Dr. Moore. I just want to thank you very much for shedding the light for me. And I want just to say to you that I'm an honor to even hear you speak, because there's not a lot of people who are able to speak or, you know, be outspoken in what you say because of fear. I just want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Just as a factual question, having looked at the record quite closely, if you look at international standards of human rights, the record of Hezbollah was quite good. That's just a fact. And you know, all the propaganda in the world and all the threats and intimidation simply can't change that fact. On the basic issues, about 1,200 Lebanese were killed. 80% of them were civilians. About 200 Hezbollah fighters were killed, about 1,000 Lebanese civilians. On the Israeli side, 160 people were killed, of whom about 43 were civilians. So whether you look at the numbers absolutely or relatively, 1,000 civilians versus 43 civilians, or 80% civilians versus 25% civilians. However you look at the record, Hezbollah came out looking quite well. You take the question of the use of cluster bombs. Hezbollah, the estimates are, they used about 3,000 cluster bomblets against Israel. Israel used 4.6 million cluster bomblets against Lebanon. However you look at the record, Hezbollah's record was, relatively speaking, it was quite good. I mention it because we shouldn't be afraid of the facts. If you want to say Hezbollah acted like a terrorist state, okay, say it. But then you have to say that Israel acted like 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times the terrorist state that Hezbollah acted like. That's what the numbers show. Those are the facts. Now, there were disgusting reports put out by places like Human Rights Watch, which are a bunch of cowards, which tried to put the whole burden of blame on Hezbollah for the war and the burden of human rights violations. It was factually untrue. And there's an old British expression, facts are stubborn things. We should stick closely to the facts. We should never fear them. And if you look closely at the facts, the Hezbollah record was simply not bad. In fact, I think, in fact, rather good.
Thank you. Many thanks to you, Doctor. And I would like to ask a fundamental question regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict. And my question is revolving around the conception of the resolution. Like, what do you think will be the suitable solution? Two-state solution?
Like, my question will be, what do you support? Two-state solution, or one secular moderate, or one democratic state solution? Like, during the 70s, as you know, like, there were several dichotomies within the PLO and other continuing organizations. So what do you think? Thank you.
The question basically is whether I support a one-state or a two-state settlement. There are two ways to answer the question. I can give you my personal opinion and say I'm from the old world, I don't believe in any states. And some people may be happy with that answer, some people may say, oh my God, he's a communist or an anarchist. And my own view is it's completely irrelevant. What difference does it make what I personally think? For one thing, I don't even live there. What difference does it make? What's important is, what is the opinion of the whole of enlightened humankind? And the opinion is that Israel has to fully withdraw to its June 1967 border. I don't see politically, what sense it makes to try to defy the whole of international opinion. It's tough enough winning a cause when you have the opinion on your side, then how can we possibly win the cause if we want to defy the whole of international opinion? That's where international opinion is at now. Now you say you want to change it? Fine. But bear in mind what you're saying. It's not easy to change the whole of international opinion. It changes very slowly. Take the case the other day, the current president of the General Assembly from Nicaragua, Descoto, when he wanted to justify a Palestinian state, he invoked UN Resolution 181, the partition resolution. International law, public opinion, it's always built on precedent. That means what came before. Now you want to change the whole precedent and get one state? Then be honest about what you're saying. You're condemning the Palestinians under occupation to at least another century of occupation. And let's be honest about it. And let's not, you know, sit around and manufacture and fabricate all kinds of formulas which are going to condemn those people over there to eternal misery. It's not a question of what I think, it's what international opinion says. And then you have to ask yourself politically, is it wise or unwise to try to defy the whole of international opinion? I think it's unwise. And it has nothing whatever to do with my personal opinion.
Thank you.
Just very quickly, announcement. We do have a mic. Please ask your question. When you get the mic, we'll go to the sister side. Sister, the front.
The question is, in my opinion, is Zionism fundamentally a religious movement built on the Jewish religion, or is it a secular movement which has nothing whatever to do with the Jewish religion? I guess the answer, if you think about it hard enough, the answer is it's probably both. Most of the original Zionists were completely secular. They had no belief in religion. They were atheists, because most of the original Zionists were socialists, labor Zionists, as they were called. And at that time, socialism was militantly atheist. On the other hand, there's no doubt that there were, maybe you could say, beneath the surface, certain religious yearnings which were at the bottom of the Zionist idea. So I'd say it's probably both. Having those said, and I understood you were just asking me my opinion, I don't think it's that important a question. See, my view is you could be anything. You, as far as I'm concerned, you can be a Zionist, you can be a thisist or a thatist. I just want to know where do you stand on basic issues of truth and justice. That's the only thing that concerns me. All the rest, okay, we can go to some Starbucks and sit around and talk about it. But in the real world of politics, those just don't seem to me to be very important questions.
I listened carefully to what are the relevant things that we should focus on when you translated tell the truth. One of them is ethnic cleansing. And yet at the same time when you go to suggest
what it is that we need to do, you are concentrating on occupation, which which is a lesser form of ethnic cleansing than what you are emphasizing. And I am a refugee, and I'm concerned not just with the occupation. I am concerned with the ethnic cleansing and telling the truth, and actually, that is the thrust and the crux of the Palestinian question. How do I then concentrate on the occupation? Just listening to your answer earlier, it seems like it's inconsistent, and I'm being candid, as you
should be.
To.
You should
and,
be.
And I really need you to clarify this. Do you support 194, which is the resolution of the return of the refugees to homes from which they were uprooted?
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, I'm glad that he's the questioner is respectful enough to be honest, because I think it's disrespectful to say one thing in public and to mutter something else in private. So I appreciate the honesty, and I'm glad you asked. The basic question he asked is as follows. He said he listened closely to my remarks, and he said the focus of my remarks was on the occupation. But he says there's another, or in fact, he says, the main problem, that's the problem of the refugees. And the refugee problem cannot be reduced to the question of occupation. So he asks, I know where you stand on the occupation, but where do you stand on what he considers to be the crux of the problem, the refugee issue? And then he puts it to me point blank, do I support UN Resolution 194 from December 1948, the resolution on the right of return or and compensation? So let me start with the basics. Number one, I reiterate, it's not my opinion that's important. The UN General Assembly every year reiterates that the basis of the refugees question has to be UN Resolution 194. That is not a question that's open to dispute. UN Resolution 194, the compensation return resolution, has to be the foundation for resolving the refugee question. Number two, it'll come as a surprise to many people in the audience, I think. All the main human rights organizations have said unequivocally the Palestinians have the right of return. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the mainstream human rights organizations have all supported the right of return. For me, that's the important issue, not what I think. What is the considered opinion of enlightened humankind? And there's no dispute. You are correct on that. That's what all the human rights organizations say. That's what the United Nations General Assembly says every year. Now, I want to add to that. Because honest people, you want to be honest, I want to be honest. Honest people have to recognize that's a tough issue. I'm not talking now about the right. The right, in my opinion, is not open to dispute or debate. All of the international organizations have upheld the right of return. But then comes the tough part, implementing it. How do you implement it? Now, some of you may say, aha, Finkelstein is now retreating. What do you mean implemented? If you support the right, then you support its implementation. One B follows from A. And for a long time, I myself thought B follows from A. If you support the right, then you must support its full implementation. That's how I saw it. But then I kind of had not a revelation, but I had some practical experience which allowed me to think of the question slightly differently. So hear me out. I'm not making any kind of comparison in terms of suffering. I'm simply making a comparison at the level of principle. Please remember that for what I'm about to say. I am not comparing suffering. I'm discussing principle. A couple of years ago, actually a year ago this past September, I was denied tenure from my university. And the opinion of everyone I consulted was, of course I deserved tenure, and of course if I went to court, I would win that right. My case was open and shut. DePaul University, in fact, itself said in its last statement, Finkelstein was an outstanding teacher and a prolific scholar. Well, tenure is based on teaching and scholarship. So they themselves acknowledged I should have gotten tenure. But I had an excellent lawyer who's currently a very good friend of mine, Lynn Bernabe. She handles a lot of the Muslim trust cases, the one in Texas and others. She's a good egg, wonderful human being, and smart. She said to me, Norman, you have to make a decision. And the decision is simple. If you go to court and you try to win that right, it'll probably take you around 6 years, because that's how long tenure cases take to win in court. And it's going to consume you for 6 years. You're going to have to write up the briefs, go through tons of material. It's going to become your life for 6 years. So you have to make a decision. The decision is, will you put your life on hold for 6 years and win your right in court, your right which plainly is yours? Or, she said, you accept a settlement which is not your right, but something instead of your right. I had to make a decision. I said to myself, you know what? I don't really believe in academic freedom. I think the whole thing is a farce, and I'm not going to spend 6 years trying to prove academic freedom is something which I don't believe even exists. And I'd rather speak out on Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, and all the rest. I'd rather use those 6 years for my politics rather than for my person. That was the choice. So I said, okay, Lynn, I know I have the right, if I can use the expression, I have the right to return to DePaul. But I'll accept a settlement instead. And let's work on a settlement. And the settlement we agreed had to have two components. Number one, DePaul was going to acknowledge the wrong it had done to me. For a year, it engaged in a campaign of character assassination to destroy me. And you're going to have to clear the record. You're going to have to acknowledge my teaching record and my record as a scholar. And number two, there had to be a material component, because I'm now unemployed for life. I cannot get a job anywhere. I couldn't even get a job in a nursery school. My name has been destroyed. So there had to be a statement, and there had to be material compensation. In my view, the same basic principle applies to the Palestinians. There is the option. It's not for me to decide. I know that. But there is the option to the Palestinians, an option of a settlement. And the settlement would include a public statement by Israel recognizing the colossal injustice it inflicted on the Palestinians in 1948 and some sort of compensation. I am not telling the Palestinians what to do. It's their right. On the other hand, I am not going to project an image of such total inflexibility that it makes already a tough conflict tougher to resolve. That's my position. But in the last analysis, I know, I have no doubt, it's their right. I've met many Palestinians I couldn't possibly claim to the intimacy of knowledge that you have. I have my closest friend is Musa Abu Heshesh from Fawar camp outside Hebron, and he's the most wonderful guy in the world. But he says to me, Norm, I'm a conservative on this right of return. I grew up in a refugee camp. My father's life was destroyed, and I'm pretty conservative. So I say to him, okay, so what do you want? And his answer is, present us with an offer. Let's see what you're willing to present us with, and then we'll decide. I have complete confidence that Palestinian people are perfectly reasonable. They're perfectly amenable to a reasonable settlement of the conflict and a reasonable settlement of the refugee question. I have no doubt about that. And I have no doubt that they don't want to live in eternity fighting a battle which means for them and their children and their grandchildren lives of misery. And then you figure out how to do it. But I think it can be done. And that to me is the important thing. Don't give your enemy an excuse not to negotiate. Always be reasonable. I don't mean give up your fundamental rights, but be reasonable and show to the world who is blocking that settlement. It is not the Palestinians. The record is very clear. It is not the Palestinians. And we shouldn't now try to create new obstacles so it appears that it's the Palestinians. They're perfectly reasonable, perfectly rational, and this problem too can be resolved if we're reasonable about it.
Thank you. Imam Abdul Ali Musa wants to make a quick comment. We do have to wrap up, so I'm going to take two more questions thereafter. Because the Arabic program wants to start here at the Islamic Council.
Because there's so many millions of Palestinians who are outside of the country, right? If they all come back, the problem of population and what kind of system we have, if you're 60% of the people, you don't have a problem. So I find a problem with the idea of dealing with the world courts and the world system. The people of Palestine have been overly patient, and every time they even get close to any kind of solution, Oslo in 2000, the second Intifada was not something the Muslims or Palestinians invented, right? It was this idiot Sharon going to Masjid al-Aqsa, right, and starting the problem. In other words, the problem that we still have now comes from Sharon and people like that. As soon as the people get close to peace, whether it's Gandhian or democratic, right? Or if the Palestinian people vote in a system or vote in a people that they feel is good for them, right? If they send troops all over the world for democracy and the people of Palestine vote in a democracy, right? The people they want, they say, we can't have that. What I'm saying is that our people are told that if you vote or if you have the attitude that we like, it's okay. But if you do anything that you like, then we have a problem. So this stuff of not recognizing who the problem is and being reasonable, the people have been reasonable for 60 years, living in tents and refugee camps and all over the world. The people of Palestine have already been overly reasonable. No. Just a minute, because we got to be clear on who we are and what we listen to, and how people try to shift us from real issues, right? Hey, we're being oppressed, killed, and murdered, with men, women, and children, right? By the millions all over the world. And so it's not some mystical people that's causing us some problem. And if it wasn't a few Zionists controlling the media, why is it that any time somebody speak up, in the black community, you probably never heard of Public Enemy, but when they start talking in the 80s about Zionism, our most popular rappers got attacked and you don't even know about it anymore, right? You don't even know whatever happened to Professor Griff and all of those. It is because of Zionist media, right? If don't nobody know about all the votes that happened in the world, well, how they don't know about it, huh? It's the media, isn't that right? Keep it out of your mind. That means somebody is controlling the media. As far as the president of Iran is concerned, he gave the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest speech they had down there, right? And you got to be careful about translations, about the New York Times when they translate. There are people here who speak Farsi as a natural language, and they know that the president has never said that we're going to just sweep the Zionist state away. The way they put it, and they repeat the lie so often that they make our people, who are very wise and very intelligent, right, look like idiots. Well, we're not going for that no more. People saying what we say, and then you go or we go and believe that our people said what they said. No, we're not going for that anymore. I'll close in a minute. The last thing is, don't want to take all the time, but you remember Durban, conference in Durban? The whole world is back to Zionism is racism. Bam, you get the World Trade Center and you get everything else to shift. And it happened twice, World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2. Every time there's been something close to the people of America or the people of the world loving us, recognizing us, some idiot so-called Muslim pops up, right, and does something, either higher or invented.
No, that's all right.
No, I'm just trying to say.
No, you should.
What happened to us ain't no myth, right? No, I'm not talking. I'm just saying. This stuff happened. I'm talking to the audience. Whatever, I'm talking to the audience. Hey man, this stuff ain't no myth that's happening to us. And we gotta keep focused on who is doing what to who. We ain't doing nothing to nobody, right? But trying to save our children. And I'll close with this. If you talk about policies, Iron Fist, you ever heard about Iron Fist? Breaking heads, breaking arms, right? What do they do in Lebanon? What did they do in Lebanon in 81, 82? Bomb from the land, the sea, and the air. Isn't that right? I'm telling you, many people say as small as Lebanon is, 40,000 dead and 1 million homeless. Anytime they get ready. And then who's the terrorist? Hezbollah is the terrorist, not the Zionists, right? Cluster bombs, phosphorus bombs, bombing from the New Jersey out in the water. And then they make it look like we got to be civilized. This is insanity. We got to be civilized, and they bomb us from the land, the sea, and the air, and if we don't like it, they say, you're a terrorist and non-intellectual. Okay, I'm sorry, but I'm just telling you, I don't want to.
I'm sorry because time is up for that. I'm going to allow Dr. Finkelstein just to wrap up real quick.
maybe a minute or two to wrap up, and we're going to move discussion to the hall because we need to respect the hour program. We were expected to finish approximately 10 minutes ago. I do deeply apologize for that, and please do remain seated until the closing remarks. I'll turn it over to Dr. Finkelstein. Thank you. Mr. Blaine, we respect your opinion, but please respect the audience and the program as it goes along. Thank you very much. Right. Mr. Finkelstein, the floor is yours.
I think I had plenty of time, and I was glad he had time also at the end. I don't think anyone should have to just sit passively and listen to me, and I'm glad that you had time to speak. My only finishing remarks is, if you're interested, I'm very happy to come back another time, and let's continue. Thank you.